Welcome to Iconicast. In today's episode, we're going to be talking to Phil Adam and Brian Anderson, two experts on electric cars. Phil is an old friend of mine and a neighbor here in my fair city, Plymouth, Minnesota, the Plymouth without the rock. Phil is an engineer who's quite likely affected your life directly. If you ever go into buildings, school buildings, government buildings, commercial or industrial buildings during the summer and the air conditioner is on, there's a very good chance Phil or one of his colleagues at Daikin Applied Engineering designed that air conditioning or installed it. Phil also works with me in several areas of environmental and political activism. Phil is one of the key people responsible for assembling the thoughts and wishes of Minnesota Democrats across the state into a coherent platform of issues. He's also on the board of directors of the DFL Environmental Caucus. DFL is what we call Democrats in Minnesota. And Phil and I are both on that board, and we work together in progressive political messaging, a passion we both share. Phil introduced me to our other guest on today's show, Brian Anderson. Brian grew up near the banks of the Wisconsin River in Portage, Wisconsin, and earned a degree in electrical and computer engineering from the highly prestigious UW-Madison. He now lives in Minnesota, where he enjoys a storied career designing technologies used in automotive diagnostics and medical devices. Brian also lives in my fair city, Plymouth, so we're all neighbors. Both Phil and Brian have chosen to spend a huge amount of their free time spreading the word on electric vehicles. As engineers, they have an understanding of the technology. Both Brian and Phil have an excellent sense of how to drag important concepts kicking and screaming out of the weedy rabbit holes they live in into the open to re-explain them and make them accessible to regular people like you and me. We've asked them to join us on the show to talk about electric cars, their benefits and drawbacks, but most importantly, to address and dispel, where appropriate, misconceptions about this important new technology. Well, Brian, let's start with you. Who the heck are you and why are you interested in electric cars?
Sure. Well, I'm a recently retired engineer and self-proclaimed geek, but I'm also very passionate about the environment. So I have had solar panels and driven EVs since 2015. That's really my primary motivation, but I do confess to having a lot of fun with them too. I mean, they are amazing machines. They're the future. And I don't want to live in the past. I want to live in the future. Or, you know, the as close to it as I can get. And EVs are definitely a big part of that. And they're really the singular thing that most people in the United States can do to lower their carbon footprint. Solar panels and EVs. I think my carbon footprint is pretty low. And that's really what motivates me.
Phil, what about you? Who the heck are you?
I'm going to just say ditto what Brian said. I'm a soon to be retired engineer, and I've had electric cars for a little bit longer, 10 years, almost 10 years. And so I'm solar panels for 12. I was one of the early adopters. And, you know, when you do heat transfer calculations for a living, you kind of understand how carbon dioxide works in the atmosphere, that kind of thing. And the cars are a lot of fun. And it's one of the best ways to reduce your carbon footprint. I would say our carbon footprint is about a fourth of what it was 10 years ago. And I do need to heat pump my natural gas furnace and hot water heater.
That's on the list.
Right. And our gas stove. That'll mm-hmm. be down the list.
So. Yeah. Yep. I don't have an electric car, but I did reduce my carbon footprint by moving a while back and moving to very close to work. Next step will be electric car. So now next question for each of you, Brian first, what kind of electric car do you drive or cars do you drive?
Sure. Well, if we're recording the video, you can see behind me my current stable of electric cars, which is a Tesla Model Y and a Chevy Bolt. And both of those are 2020. Who knows? They may be the last cars we ever buy. EVs do last a long time, but that's what we're currently driving. And I no longer own any object that requires petroleum to operate. I'm fully electric.
So your lawn, I see those who, this is a good audio podcast, but I can see your cars in your garage and I can see your house that's covered with solar panels. Mm-hmm. And I also see a lawn that's been cut. Well, it looks like it's kind of died in the drought.
Yeah, it's sort of so a
you obviously don't waste water on your lawn, but right. But you also have electric appliances for your lawn and garden stuff as well.
Yep, electric mower, electric leaf blower, electric chainsaw, electric snowblower. In fact, that's the toughest one. They snowblowers require the biggest gasoline motor. So, you know, the technology had to mature a little bit, but these days you can go out and get a decent two-stage snowblower that handles, I would say, the biggest Minnesota storms, provided that you get out there maybe in the middle of a 12-inch, you know, once every 10 years storm and keep it clear. But
right.
Yeah, they just work.
And Phil, what are you driving?
So we had a Leaf. Right now it's a Model Y, a 2020. In fact, Brian's license plate and mine differ by about 3 digits, I think. Or like mine's EHH304 and yours is 317 or something.
307, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, we differ by three.
Three. Engineering brain, remembering the sums.
And we have a 2017 BMW i3 with the pony motor, little 34 horsepower generator.
Yep.
That allows the car to allows you to do long distance trips.
That my first EV was a pure BEV version of that i3. It's a great little car. Unfortunately, they don't sell them anymore in the US, but you can still get them used.
So you both have Teslas. And so we're gonna diverge from the main topic just for a second, because I don't want to spend a lot of time on this. I know you know what I'm gonna ask you right now.
Yep.
I do okay, a more specific question. Washington Post, Dateline, 10 minutes ago. Twitter suspended the accounts of more than a half a dozen journalists from CNN, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and other outlets Thursday evening. This has happened. Those journalists had said bad things about Elon Musk or Twitter.
Hmm.
So he's taking out, what is that, the fifth estate or the fourth estate, whatever it is, the journalist estate. Anyway, yeah. So you didn't buy your cars after Elon Musk went rogue. Would you have?
You know, it's funny. I just responded to a Facebook comment today. I'm just all about the environment. So the person I commented or replied to was talking about Elon supporting the free speech of QAnon and other, you know, right-wing crazies, to put a label on them. And I said, you know what? I don't care. Because what Elon is doing in the real world, in the physical world, the one that matters, where our grandchildren and great-great-grandchildren have to live in, he's fixing that. And I think he's done more than just about every other person to date. So I don't track that too much. But so, yes, I would probably still buy a Tesla.
What about you, Phil?
It's got, right now it's got the best charging network. Rest of the industry will not catch up for at least a couple years. If you take a look at the efficiency of the cars, all four Teslas are they're in the top 10. The four Tesla cars are in the top 10. I think that's quite right. I think that's close.
Certainly, the S and the X are not as efficient, but yeah, they're up there.
Yeah, mm-hmm. they're 120, like our Model Ys are 120 miles per gallon equivalent. The Model 3 is 140. Mm-hmm. You take a look at the Jaguar I-Pace, I think it's like 94 or some really.
I don't think the Mach-E is that great either.
Yeah, they're. Mm-hmm. We can go further than conventional car company, or we can go further than, I'll call it, domestic car companies with the same battery.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Simply because we're more efficient.
Yeah, so we're talking about it from an engineering standpoint. I think Phil kind of said the same thing I did, which is that's what matters. You know, I think Elon, I mean, we could go on about this for a bit, but I would remind people that, and I'd encourage people to watch the Saturday Night Live episode that he hosted. But in his monologue, he admitted, I have Asperger's. And I think people don't, for one, it takes some knowledge of medicine to know what that means, but he's not competent when it comes to social interactions. Hmm. And it's unfortunate because he's one of the wealthiest people on earth, but he's not competent. And that allows me to give him a measure of a break.
Yeah.
I'm not saying you have to, but
people who are extremely privileged don't get the same social, sometimes don't get the same social support other people do because no one wants to say no to them, you know?
That's true.
Which is also true, right? Yep. Which is something that, Brian, you mentioned, I guess what I think, what I would like our readers to kind of understand are two things. One is, what are the real reasons that you want an electric car? And you probably there's probably more than just one reason. There's a few reasons, including that they're cool, but other reasons as well. But then also, I want to touch on the objections people have for buying electric cars. And I'll try to think of what the objections are and bring them up to you, but you may come up with your own, things that you've heard from people. But why, you mentioned, Brian, electric cars last longer. So why do they last longer?
Well, you know, again, I have the opportunity of speaking from an engineering standpoint. There are simply far fewer parts to break. And as we say in engineering, the part that's not there can't fail. So the electric motor in an EV, the motor itself has one moving part. It's a rotor inside a stator, which sits still. The gasoline motor, the equivalent, the power plant, has hundreds of moving parts. And they operate at extreme temperatures, extreme pressures, extreme loads. I think Phil is a mechanical engineer. I'm not, but I've been exposed to a lot of them. So I can sort of speak to it, but Phil can probably do that better. But that's probably the main thing. The other one is it's related, I guess. They're far less expensive to maintain. And the longer you keep them, of course, like just about anything physical will continue operating, your cost just goes down because you're deferring costs. You don't have the cost that you would have maintaining a gas car. And I know I snuck in a different answer there, but
Phil, do you want to add anything to why that?
Yeah, at $4 a gallon, our electric cars probably cost me, if you compare them to a equivalent SUV, we probably paid a 10 grand premium for them. And that savings just in fuel alone is recouped in 60,000 miles. I expect my car to last 300,000 miles, maybe five. The first thing I expect to fail will be the body from rust. I plan on replacing the suspension at 150,000 or thereabouts. Plan on going 300,000 with the car easily. I wanted to get back to the investor question. Investors are ready to boot Elon Musk out anyway, because they think right now the stock's at about 160 pounds, $160 per share right now. Investors think it's undervalued. But they want to get Musk out of there because he's not running the company anymore right now.
He owns 14% of Tesla.
Right.
And then the next seven owners of stock own 14.1% or something like that. So
there's one guy that's got quite a sizable fortune. So I concur with Brian that he's got Asperger's syndrome. So. He doesn't. I mean, just the fact that he treats employees like chattel. Hey, you should be willing to work 100 hours a week or 120 hours a week. That's not progressive.
Yeah. So, I have a question on the longevity question again. Is a car like a Tesla going to have its suspension majorly overdone in 150,000 miles? I would imagine it would last longer than that. And modern cars don't really rust like they used to. You might not rust out. I would expect you to do the next big thing in your car you'd have to fix or replace would be the batteries. How long do the batteries last in a Tesla, you think?
The batteries should be, there's some anecdotal evidence that the batteries are 80% good at 300,000 miles. Okay. The suspension in the car is no different than a suspension in a Lincoln. And BMWs, you want to replace them between around 150,000 because they make them responsive. And when you make things responsive, You're not driving a battle tank. You're driving something that wiggles. And
it's not the entire suspension either, right? Of the suspension components, you have rigid components that are made of aluminum in the case of a Tesla. And they, I think from a metallurgical standpoint, they're not being fatigued in an area where they're fundamentally changing. So they're going to last forever. The springs, same thing. They're steel springs because you can't make spring. You have to make springs out of steel. Springs are designed to operate within a range that effectively makes them last forever. So the only piece that really wears out is the gas strut piece, the oil and air component that dampens things, mm-hmm. shock absorbers.
Right.
And those do wear out because they have seals. They have, they're undergoing the type of wear mechanism that eventually does cause them to fail.
Right.
So when Phil says suspension, I think that's probably what he's talking about.
Yeah. It's just, those are actually the part that's designed to be the part that wears out.
Yeah.
And they're easy to take out. They're not that expensive. So I wouldn't even count that as replacing the suspension. I would just say that's like changing your oil, only less often.
What? And since you brought up the battery, Greg, because I think this is maybe one of the hottest topics that I hear again and again and again when I'm talking to people, but the batteries, as Phil said, they wear down to a point where you have less range. My Model Y is already down to about 290 miles of range. Phil, I don't know what you're seeing.
No, I haven't paid attention.
Yeah. So. But the point being that there's a relatively sharp wear phase that happens toward the beginning. Then they level out for a very long time and then they just gradually degrade. But that's the point is, it's not the type of wear out that will cause a sudden failure and leave you stranded on the road. Mm-hmm. It's just that a year later, you're going to wake up and go, geez, I used to be able to make this trip with no charging. Now I have to stop partway through. And by the way, that's 5 years down the road when there are going to be twice or three times as many chargers. So it begins to get, basically what you're paying is a little extra time to stop and charge.
Yeah.
And our batteries may lose some capacity, but the motor will maintain its, I will have the same efficiency at 300,000 miles as I have with a brand new car.
Yep.
You cannot say that for a gas car. Gas cars wear out. Gas cars get worse efficiency over time. The other thing is that the catalytic converter of a gas car is only as good as that oxygen sensor. that's in the exhaust pipe, or that's one of many
wear components in a gas
on the exhaust manifold.
Yeah.
And if that oxygen sensor fails or goes out of tolerance, then you start running rich, which means you lose efficiency, which means you start carboning up your catalytic converter, which means you put out much more toxic fumes. In fact, I suspect there's very few cars on the road more than 5 years old that are still within manufacturer's spec for their catalytic converter.
Mm. Yeah, and if you ever drive behind a car and you smell a rotten egg smell, mm-hmm. that's a clogged up catalytic converter.
Right. It's not a Tesla.
No.
It's not an electric car.
No.
Yeah. Now, since we're talking about, let's continue with the battery discussion a little bit. I think your point, this is a really important point you made, that the battery getting older and therefore having less capacity does not mean that when you press your foot on the accelerator pedal, it goes 80% of what it used to go. It still works like it was before. And so one question I have, do you expect that in 300,000 miles, when your battery finally decide you're going to replace it and go to that range back again, is that going to be as the same price relative to inflation as a battery is now? Or are they going to change their price? And is it going to have the same capacity as a battery is now? Or is there going to be enough of a change in technology, barring the magic technology that we don't know about yet, that gives you a 10,000 mile battery or something? But just given what you think about batteries now, will the 300,000 mile replacement battery be an upgrade to your car?
So that's maybe 10 years, Phil, or no, probably 15 years.
Let's say 15 years.
For me. I've been driving about 20,000 miles a year.
Let's say 15 years from now, will you be getting the same battery or a slightly better battery, or will it be a magically great battery or what?
The other thing will be that that battery is not integral with the frame, I don't believe. And if you have 10 million Teslas that are similar in design, then it makes sense for NAPA to have a replacement. I'm saying NAPA, but it makes sense for some company, third party,
right?
To have a replacement battery for you. That okay, it's it won't quite be up to OEM standards, but boy, it'll be half the price, and it'll make that car a great second car. Give it another 10, 20 years.
I'll take a crack at that question too, Greg. If you pay attention to some of the new battery tech companies, I'm just going to pick on StoreDot as an example. This is an Israeli company. They have partnerships with, I think, Volkswagen and some other companies. So they're being taken seriously, and they're in this solid state battery. And I wave the air quotes because a lot of people have heard that. But that is an example of a technology that is not commercially available yet, but seems like it's going to get there. And you have a new battery architecture where instead of having graphite in the anode, you have a metal anode, meaning a solid lithium anode. And you have a, rather than a liquid or gel electrolyte, that's a hydrocarbon that's flammable. By the way, that's why lithium batteries burn. It's the electrolyte. You go to this either ceramic or some kind of a polymer that's not flammable and somehow overcomes the current issues, which is, no pun intended, growth of dendrites, things like that, which is the whole purpose of the electrolyte barrier being there. I'd be the first to say the things that the new guys are saying, they're exaggerating, right? They're not going to be there the way they're saying they will be or when they will be. But if you conservatively extrapolate, not take a leap, not to magic technology, as you said, but if you extrapolate what is in the works today and being tested in the lab, you know, presumably on the short track to being commercialized, I think all that adds up to a considerably cheaper battery replacement in 15 years. I don't think that's a very risky prediction. Mm-hmm. Phil mentioned the third party, the competitive pressures that are going to happen. Tesla itself is going to stay on top of this. When I listen to every investor call, and call after call, somebody will ask about, what about this battery? What about that? And when J.B. Straubel was CTO, and he used to be on the investor calls, he would say, we are aware of everything that's happening in the market. And if anybody has something that they don't think we're being paying attention to, call us up. We'll put it in the lab. We will begin testing it, and we will work with you. And that's why I say, I don't think some of these companies are as ready as they say they were. If they were, Tesla would partner with them. Other companies would partner with them. But so there's somewhere in between that spectrum of, you know, magic is going to happen tomorrow and magic is never going to happen, that I think leads to a considerably cheaper, more capable battery in 15 years. I think that's a really safe prediction.
There are probably 45 battery plants being put up in Europe and 45 in the United States. We provided the cooling. I mean, we're talking tens of thousands of tons of cooling for these battery plants. I mean, just massive.
I'm going to interrupt. Okay. Phil makes giant air conditioners. That's why he's saying that.
Okay. Good clarification, Greg.
In case you're wondering why he's talking about cooling plants, he makes the air conditioners for the plants.
Yeah. Yep. And, anyway, just we are. I'll get a. I mean, historically, you know, for 25, 30 years, I would get a request for five rooftops, 10 rooftops, 20 rooftops, a lot of onesies, a lot of twosies. In the last 5 years, the Jacob Javits Center was the one job I ever had that was, it was 90 some rooftops. So that was the biggest job I ever did. Okay. But everything else was 5, 10, 20. In the last 4 or 5 years, we have had at least 10 to 20 buildings of 100 rooftops. And they're all battery. They're all battery.
They're
plants.
All battery.
They're battery plants. Wow.
Wow.
Okay.
Wow.
So,
yeah. A couple were car manufacturing.
Yeah.
But generally mm-hmm. they were second tier suppliers to the car companies for battery plants.
Right. Now, just to clarify a little bit more as well, and Brian, you made reference to this. The problem with a battery is that when you have the way batteries work is that they get gunked up. That's a simple way of putting it. And how they get gunked up depends on the exact battery technology you're using. And the way the batteries are used now, that if you're asking an engineer, I need a battery here, they're going to go order a battery that has certain performance specifications. And to make the battery has the least gunking is something like a lithium battery with cobalt in it and so on. That does not mean you have to use that battery. For example, when I've spoken to people who are building peaker plants, which is, you know, solar peaker plants, you build a solar farm and you have some batteries on there so that you can store your electricity. The engineers order the same basic battery that you have in your Tesla, but just a giant version of it. They could order a battery that's 10 times bigger, less efficient, holds the same amount of electricity, might even be cheaper, but it's not what they really want to use. It isn't an optimal battery. But you want the optimal battery in your car because it's a car. You can't have a battery that's 10 times bigger and kind of works and you drag it behind on it, right? So that's what these new battery technologies are. They're trying to keep that level of performance with different materials so that gunking up is less or it holds a little more electricity. But what about the problem of, I know Phil, you and I have talked about this a lot. What about the problem of those rare minerals of cobalt and lithium? This is what people, whenever I'm at a place where people talk about electric cars, someone always says, but what about these enslaved children in the Congo? Or what about the rarity of these minerals? And these are real problems.
So Phil, well, I think you should talk about the gasoline refining.
Okay, yeah. Phil, you start off with you making the argument. Yeah, but what about
let's start with gasoline refining. You know, how do you make gasoline? Well, you get crude oil. And you, for example, it's the crude oil that we are now finding is harder and harder to find. So it takes more and more energy to get it out of the ground than the nice Saudi light that we found in 1935. And then you pipe it to, for example, Alberta tar sands, you pipe it about 2,700 miles. And it's probably through a 4-foot pipe. And I'm guessing that the energy required to pump all that oil to the refineries is probably on the order of it's going to be a gigawatt, or it could be even more. But it's an enormous amount of electricity. And I should make that calculation.
I was talking about so Greg was asking about the minerals. So I remember you saying once that cobalt was used in gasoline refining.
Yeah. So in the latest data I had was that 24% of world cobalt was used for our PCs and our phone batteries. 24% was used for electric vehicles. And 14% was used for the refining processes for gasoline as part of the catalytic processes in cracking the carbon molecules into useful molecules.
There are multiple minerals in each different battery chemistry, and cobalt is the most problematic one on a couple of different dimensions. The one you mentioned, Greg, but it is certainly possible to develop cobalt-free batteries, and I think companies are well on the path of of getting there, where there won't be cobalt in batteries anymore. One of the battery technologies that's in wide deployment now, and it's actually in use in stationary batteries, is lithium iron phosphate. So lithium iron phosphate uses no cobalt. It uses extremely common minerals of iron and phosphorus. Lithium is actually broadly available. It's extremely common in the environment. And it's mostly sourced from friendly places. There's quite a bit of it in the US. There's a lot of it in South America. There's a lot of it in Australia. And so I don't personally, from what I've read, I don't think lithium is a big issue. But nickel,
yeah,
is apparently a big challenge. And again, lithium iron phosphate batteries don't require nickel. And the trade-off is that a nickel-based battery, and we're talking about the cathode now, lithium is the anode, all these other metals are the cathode. Nickel is problematic. Nickel batteries are about, I don't know, Phil, 10 to 20% more energy dense. And yep. And that's the term you're after, Greg, when you said cars need something different than stationary batteries. What cars need is high energy density. And you can talk about volumetric density or gravimetric density or weight, but it's really gravimetric density that I think really determines the performance envelope of a moving vehicle. So lithium iron phosphate is great for a bus, for example, or a truck even. I mean, that's not trying to be a, you know, 3.9 second 0 to 60 Ford F-150. Is that really necessary, by the way? But anyway, that aside, nickel is what gives you the high performance, and that's where the current EV market is focused. But honestly, the EV market in the US is, what, 7%, something like that, Phil?
Yep.
You know, 3%. What's the other 80%? It's people who just want to get from point A to point B. They would be perfectly served by a car that gets 220 miles of range instead of 260 or 70 using a lithium iron phosphate battery instead of a nickel battery, and boom, supply chain problem solved.
And lithium iron phosphate is lower price.
Yep. And it's more durable.
Yeah.
Right. You can charge it to 100%. It's happy to charge to 100%. Those of us with today's EVs that are all nickel based batteries, we're all kind of babying our batteries, especially Teslas, because Tesla gives you access to more of the gross capacity of the battery. What that means is you're taking it further to the top and further to the bottom, and that creates more wear. Remember that dendrite term?
Yeah.
That's what creates those, is when you take the battery to its extremes. And companies like, I think GM actually, and we have a Chevy Bolt, I think they have wider bars on the end, you know, where they don't let you charge as high. They have bigger reserves on the top and bottom, which is great for battery longevity. You can either do it yourself and set your battery charging and make sure you keep it in that window, or the car can do it for you, but that means you don't have access to that extra capacity. So that's the kind of trade-off we're talking about. And that's more important, way more important with nickel batteries than with lithium iron phosphate. So I really think this is kind of a short-term situation. I don't think we're going to be talking about this in 3 or 4 years. With increases in energy density, just gradual increases, car companies, probably including Tesla, will start building in bigger margins, and we won't have to think about, what wears out a battery and what percentage can I charge to, and things like that.
There was a moment when Hurricane Harvey, I believe it was attacking Florida, and people, the concern was, I have an electric car, I can't possibly evacuate, whatever, because, you know, I don't know, whatever reason, people just have range anxiety. But Tesla sent out a signal to all the Teslas in Florida, narrowing that band at the top, or the bottom, I guess, so that they could go a little farther, charge a little more, go a little farther, to make it all the way to Georgia instead of only halfway to Georgia. By the way, on cobalt, the numbers, I'm going to add to cobalt something else. which is that the other half of the cobalt, you only described the first half, the other half of the cobalt is used in alloys of metals that are used in mostly aircraft-related for high-performance demands of turbine engines and that kind of thing. And it turns out there's more than one alloy that works perfectly well in those applications, and only one of those alloys uses cobalt, but it's just because cobalt is traditionally what they've used. They can use other minerals. So you can get about 45% or 40% of the cobalt out there free from this from this pie diagram. You can just take it out of that if you just redid the technology. That's probably a huge investment to change how they build those things.
Yeah.
I like Fiestaware as my local ceramic. And the color I prefer is cobalt. Guess what? They stop making cobalt Fiestaware. They replaced it with a non-cobalt blue, which is not quite the same blue. So there is some pressure on the market there. That's the battery end of it. Now I want to ask you, and I know...
I had one more thing about the battery I wanted to point out is that the cobalt in our batteries is only 40 to 50 pounds. So we're moving a 2-ton car. Mm-hmm. The lithium's about, 30 to 40 pounds?
I didn't think cobalt was that much. Nickel is probably a much higher level.
Nickel's the highest one, and gasoline cars need just as much nickel as our cars do, I think.
Really?
Why do they I mean, we only have 50 pounds, but
again, alloy. Yeah,
they need it in their alloys for the gas engine.
Okay, that's interesting. So it's about the same. Yeah, that's another point.
And now I'm not sure about that, but we know that nickel is used in the alloys for steel. The traditional car companies have always needed nickel.
Yeah. Stainless is made with a nickel alloy.
That's what stainless steel is. Yeah, nickel. Yeah.
And in fact, if you talk to what I've read about the Tesla supply chain is that nickel is actually their biggest bottleneck.
Mm-hmm.
But again, that's a bottleneck for all car companies.
And by the way, these minerals that are used in the batteries, you mentioned, Phil, that cobalt was used in the refinery. There's controversy over this, but my understanding is used as a substrate for an enzyme that does part of the process. And it gets lost, some of it.
It gets lost.
So they lose a little bit. I've talked to people in the industry who say, oh, we don't lose any, only a little bit. And other people say, well, they lose about 15% over the course of a year.
I mean, why would you need, no new refineries have been built in a long time.
So why would you need any more? Well, now someday you're going to say that about electric cars, right? When everybody has an electric car, you don't have to get new cobalt or whatever you're using, nickel, for the new batteries. You just, because we're going to be recycling what we're using. So it's a temporary ramping up thing. We can come back to batteries if we think of something else, but moving on to another question, which is a bit outside the car. And that is an objection I hear people make is a concern they have is when you're all charging your electric cars and everybody's got an electric car, where are we going to get the electricity to put in all those cars? By the way, this is an international podcast. I think we have at least one listener in Australia. Of our 9 or 10 listeners, at least one is in Australia.
Excellent.
But I know that Phil and I, you and I have talked a lot about this in regards to just Minnesota specifically, because Minnesota is a very unusual state with regards to electricity and petroleum. We have more pipeline in this state per capita than any other state that doesn't produce something that goes in the pipeline. Yeah, and that uses a huge amount of electricity to pipe that stuff.
Stop line 3.
And this is all going somewhere else. It's like we are also, by the way, the trains are coming through the state like crazy, and it's all going to Virginia or North Carolina.
2 blocks from my house.
Yeah. I used to live right across. Anyway. So, but the question is, what do we have to do to account for the extra electricity needed when we're driving all of our cars with electricity rather than gasoline?
The advice I would start with that is the electric grid is designed, at least in the, I'll just say generally the Midwest, actually probably pretty much nationwide. It's designed for the hottest day of the year. The grid doesn't store electricity, or at least the old grid. Now we have some batteries in the grid, but not much. So basically, generation has to be ramped up and down to match demand every hour of every day of the year. Generally speaking, you know, grid operators have to do this. It's enormously complex, but the point is that you have all of this generation capacity that is idle most of the time. And when it is most frequently idle is overnight, right? You know, people go to bed, they turn off the lights, businesses shut down, you know, they ramp down their, manufacturing ramps down, everything ramps down. The demand of electricity goes way down overnight. Most people, you know, today come home and plug in their car when they get home from work. Now, I'm not driving much. A lot of people aren't driving much anymore, but that's a general pattern. And it's interestingly a pattern that could easily be incentivized financially. In fact, Phil and I went to an Excel discussion about their EV program. They've just introduced a new program where they'll pay you $50 to charge your car, you know, over those overnight hours, $50 a year. Okay, it's not a lot of money, but it's easy to do. The cars can be programmed to do it. You set it and forget it, and they pay you $50. So it's absolutely not a stretch at all to shift that load. Let's say the load today is everybody comes home at 5:30 p.m. and plugs in. Fine. It's still, I mean, at today's penetration of 7%, it's nothing. I mean, the grid is handling 7%. Phil, maybe you'll have some numbers, but I'll just finish my example here. So shifting that load to overnight hours is a pretty much a piece of cake. And so let's take a countries that are way further along in the EV transition than the United States, Norway, several countries in Europe are now at 20, 25, 30%. You might ask the same question. What did they have to do? Did they have to rebuild their grid? No, they didn't. You don't even hear about it. It's non-news because even if every car were 100% EV tomorrow, it would represent, and maybe Phil, you have the number, but some incremental percentage of additional load. And again, that load is adjustable. It's movable. You can shift it in time to a time when the grid can handle it. So really the combination of those things mean the transition is going to happen slowly enough that utilities like Xcel are on top of this because guess what? They want to be the new gas station. That's new revenue for them. So they're all over it. They're figuring out how to deploy charging stations, get that big power to locations, sometimes remote locations. And they're also figuring out how to deliver that extra load and design those incentive programs to get people to charge when the grid has plenty of additional power. It's a solved problem, is what I would say.
In fact, I would say that I have, in the past year, 2 years, I have charged my car over 95% of the time after 9 p.m. Hmm. So I'm just naturally charging off peak, or what would be considered off peak. Right now the grid average is about 40%. If you take, you know, there's 8,760 hours in a year, divide all the electricity by that number, you come up with 40% is the average plant capacity. If every vehicle was electric, it'd be 60%.
So we need a 20% uplift.
Yeah, it's a 20% uplift. So the only thing you're concerned about is the hot day in July or August, where in theory you might need 120%. Except you would incentivize everybody still to charge from midnight to 8 a.m. when the electric load is down anyway. And by then we'll, as Brian pointed out, I think it's 7%. Yeah, are we 7% nationwide, 3% in Minnesota for penetration on electric vehicles.
Anyway,
but it's by the time you get to 50, 60, 70%, we will have V2G, vehicle to grid capability. And so, for example, in California, they are no longer incentivizing solar, but they're going to incentivize batteries. And the reason for that is that the electric load during the when the sun is shining is being met quite well by solar panels. So they don't really need more solar panels, because at 5 p.m., all of a sudden the solar panels go away and you've got this tremendous demand that's required by the grid. And so if you incentivize batteries, then that helps, with load leveling. So California is responding. So they responded by putting solar on the grid, and now they're responding by saying we need batteries on the grid, or at least that's some of the public incentive. So as long as we have good public policy, it'll be easy. It'll be easy to transition. In fact, we were on a meeting this evening, and ironically, the dealers who have been fighting electric car mandates could be selling twice as many cars as they have if they had electric vehicles on the lot, but they don't.
Isn't it also true that if we're not making gasoline and other fossil fuel-based energy fuels for vehicles, that we save some electricity with that because
absolutely.
Island Refinery has a 45 megawatt feed.
It's a 45 megawatt feed. So yeah. Pine Island Refinery in Minnesota is one of the big refineries here.
Yeah, and that's actually when you consider the amount of gasoline they process, 45 megawatts is not a lot, actually. It's I'm guessing it's in the hundreds of watts per gallon. I don't know, but that'd be a good calculation to make. But still, 45 megawatts every day, 45 megawatts times 8,760 hours. If we can record this later, I'll do the math, and we could power like 100,000 cars or 200,000 cars or some dumb thing.
So we could double or triple the number of cars we have now in Minnesota, or quadruple. Just and by that's the same amount of electricity. Just take the refinery out.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In fact, we should do that. I'll do that calculation.
Yeah, we can put it on the website later so we can see. So the grid is not going to be a problem.
Yep.
Obviously, it is. The other side of this is where we're getting electricity from. We need to electrify everything, and we need to decarbonize the grid. So electrifying everything is what we're doing in part by getting these electric cars and electric lawnmowers and chainsaws. We have to make electricity with wind turbines and solar, et cetera. And there is going to be some grid upgrading to get the wind turbines hooked into the grid as we expand outwards. When I hear people complain about that, Phil and I both live in, Brian, do you live up in Anoka County?
No, I'm in, I'm near Phil actually in Plymouth.
Okay. Yeah. Because you had mentioned you're near the trains. I didn't know if you're near the BNSF train up in.
I'm off Schmidt Lake Road.
Okay. So you're right on that train, the one that fell off the tracks a few months ago.
Yeah, exactly.
I can hear it from here. So you have, we have a grid that is got to be expanded a little bit. We all live in a part of town which is the suburbs, that if you go back to about 1980, it was all farmlands mostly and small villages. As that neighborhood was built out, and real estate and home ownership is our soul and religion in America. You know, the real estate agents are our little priests, and our belief is that home ownership is the goal. Okay, that's nirvana. No one ever asked the question, we can't have these suburbs because we'll have to put in more transmission lines and feeding lines for electrical system.
Right.
You know, the entire Twin Cities doubled in size, at least, or tripled in size over about a 40-year period.
Mm-hmm.
And the entire time we were building and building and building and building new electrical lines the entire time and upgrading them. Plymouth used to have a lot of power outages. They upgraded. We don't have them anymore. But suddenly we're building a wind turbine. It's like, oh my goodness, we're going to have to put up new transmission lines and new power lines for these things. Isn't that electrification being asked to dance backwards in high heels like Ginger Rogers? Isn't it the case that with everything you talk about and do regarding electric cars, there's always something like electric cars use nickel. Well, so do ICE cars. But no one asks that question. Isn't that a little bit annoying to you guys that electric cars are being held to a standard against the perfection of the internal combustion car? Before you answer that, I'll just say one thing. I was having a conversation with an engineer who builds electric trucks. And I said something like, when do you think they perfected how long do you think it took them to perfect the internal combustion engine? And he said, they perfected it. and this has been 150 years.
Yeah.
So where do you think, how do you think you get people to understand that electric car technology is there? That it'll improve incrementally here and there, but it's already ready to go. We don't have to wait for the next technology to come. We don't have to wait for the grid to get upgraded. That we're there. You're comfortable with the fact that we're there now, right? But how do you convince people of that?
Yeah. So Phil, I think you and I have probably collectively had that conversation at least 1,000 times. And to be honest, Greg, it's different with every person. It's more like I'll answer a question with a question. What exactly is it about electric vehicles that you're worried about? Because I have answered every concern 9 different ways. But I need to know what the individual is worried about. And you brought up some great ones, right? And there are 10 or 12 more objections, concerns, misconceptions, outright lies that people have adopted. And you just have to find out what that is and address it. Every last one of them, I'm convinced now I'm bulletproof. I mean, I can take any question about an EV and help walk you through it, whoever you are, and understand why your objection is, not to criticize you. Everybody has concerns. Everybody's worried about things, but let's talk you down off the ledge and explain why, you can really relax. And you can go buy an electric vehicle because there's one that will work for you. And honestly, with, 5, 10% of the people I've talked to over these many years, it's been, you have a use case that I don't have a good solution for you yet. Mm-hmm. It's like we visited a friend in Alaska. She lives in an inholding of Denali State Park. Has a beautiful view of Denali when it's not covered in clouds. And she's in this 30-some lot, 5-acre lots. And the only reason they have power is that there's a guy that set up a diesel generator, right, in the woods. And that's where they get their power from. They pay like 25, 30 cents a kilowatt hour. I don't know what it is, but it's off the grid. This whole neighborhood is way off the grid in Alaska. And you know what? I don't have a renewable solution for you yet, right? The cost to put up enough wind and solar and batteries to give you equivalent reliability to that diesel generator is still out of reach, but it won't be forever. And it's the same with EVs.
But when I hear people complaining about electric cars, I also have those questions. Phil and I have been talks with people ask us, and you hear those questions again and again. And I think they all start to sound like this. What about the tires? Electric cars use tires and they wear out and it's a big pollution problem. What are you going to do about that? Because not only are the problems the same as with ICE cars, but often, mm-hmm. Don't ask what is the battery about? Ask what is the energy supply about? So you can compare a battery, which is built in a factory, is being fed electricity from your solar panels versus Alberta tar sands being taken out of the ground, destroying the environment in that general region, being piped and trucked and trained to the extent that 300% of the energy is in moving it into your refinery and into your car. Yep. Mm-hmm. And then guess how much of that energy you get to use when you run your car? A little less than half.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there are the general objections of charging, where, how does that work? How far can I go? What about road trips? And then the tougher questions get to be, what about going to driving to Northern Alberta you know, what about towing my 8,000 pound trailer, you know, which are obviously edge cases at this point, but those dominoes are falling. I mean, there will be a solution for every single transport. Look, the Tesla Semi is coming out, right? I taught a community ed class for Rochester, and I had a lady in there. She was very interesting, a little older than I am, I think. She was in Rochester only to be treated at the Mayo Clinic, which Minnesotans know is a pretty, it's like a tourist destination, right? For people who need healthcare. She was intent. She was ex-military too. So she had a very can-do attitude. She was like, here's what I need. I want to be able to tow my giant fifth wheel trailer across the country, and I want to do it on electric. And I said, you know, the Tesla Semi could totally fill your needs. She kind of was like, oh, really? Tell me more. Where do I order this?
Well, that brings up another point as well, which I think is my personal philosophy is that the whole energy transition, people think of it as we're going to suffer. It's going to be hard. It's going to cost a lot. When really, we're not going to suffer. It's going to be easier. It's going to be cool. And we're going to make money rather than lose money.
We're going to save money. Yeah.
Right. We don't have to change. We don't have to change our life way as much. But there are also life way changes that I think are good to consider. Mm-hmm. Not to force on people, but to consider. When you are buying a car, this is a very common Minnesota thing. I know many people have had this decision to make. You have a cabin. You have a boat. Mm-hmm. You move stuff to the cabin and back. That's kind of extensive. So you buy a car that allows you to put a holder on the back plus a trailer with your boat on it. Mm-hmm. And you move your boat to the cabin and then you leave it there. But every year you pull it out and stick it on the lawn and put it back in again. So you must have a car that can do this with your boat. Mm-hmm. So therefore you drive a car that has a transmission and an engine strong enough horsepowers, you think, to carry around your boat. And then you get tired of doing that and you hire somebody to do it for you, but you still bought that car. In other words, or even you do it yourself, but you do use that car to do that one thing two times a year, but you have it all year long.
Right.
Now, I'm not sure what the good analogy of that would be. It's kind of like, you know, I have a really, really, really warm winter coat. And since I like to walk around a little bit in it, like to the grocery store, I have yellow flashing lights that are attached to it. And I have one of those big fur hats that when I moved to Minnesota, everybody else had. And I got one now. It's no longer in fashion. So I look strange, but I used to fit in. And I have gloves. And I'm not going to wear them in July. I'm not going to wear them in August. I'm not going to put on all my warm clothes just because I need them those 10 days a year when it's below zero. I've changed the clothes that I wear. If there was an attitude that was different and maybe a methodology, like there should be a service. You need to rent, and it's called a car rental place, by the way. It sort of exists. But if they can extend their service, we will give you the whopping big ass truck for this many dollars and you rent it for a weekend. And that's when you move your boat in and out. The rest of the year, you save $100 a month, $200, $300, $400 a month driving a car that's efficient, fun to drive, effective, and fits your day-to-day use case rather than the once-a-year use case. Yep. That's a philosophical change that sounds like it makes sense, but why do people never think of it? You know, and maybe there has to be a way of incentivizing that and making it really easy for people to adopt that method, and then they're going to find life is easier.
Yeah, we do make life harder for ourselves than we need to, and I think, you know, the cost argument is a great one too. We will actually save money. This is no longer a question of, oh, it's going to cost us so much. No, it's actually going to save us money. So whether you're talking about renewable energy or EVs, it's all cheaper in the future.
Now, Phil, I know you have a method that you have told me about of convincing people to consider an electric car when you meet them at events. We're at the library parking lot and there was a parade or something, and now electric car people are around. Because they do that, and I say to you, Phil, I like electric car, but twice, three times a year, I go up to my cabin in Wisconsin, and when I do that, I also drive down to my friend in Iowa's house. It's a big giant loop I make. There's no way I could do an electric car.
Yeah, so what I do, Brian, what I do is set him in the car, and I get him in the driver's seat, and I say, well, plunk in the address. Where do you want to go, Florida? And they plunk it in and it shows them all 11 charging stations all the way down there. Where are you going to go? Oh, my son lives in California. They plunk in that address and they just look at the map and they see that it's going to take them, you know, 22 hours, and they're going to wait 15 minutes here and 10 minutes there, and then they're kind of, oh my gosh, this is pretty easy.
I'll be darned.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the cost you pay, the cost you pay in time charging on a trip, because you just spend a little more time charging your car on a trip than you might with gasoline. Because
yeah, we pay, so we pay about a dime a mile.
So, but the time cost.
The cost in time is maybe a long trip is several minutes more.
Oh, yeah. So, Brian, how many long trips? Like we've done about 17, 20,000 miles of long trips. You've done a lot of long trips too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did two in November. I drove 6,000 miles in the month of November.
Oh, wow.
Round trips to Savannah, Georgia, and to Norwalk, Connecticut. It's the third time we've done the Norwalk, Connecticut drive. And those were in cooler weather too. So I think my time spent charging, and we also went out to Montana last summer. So to your point, Phil, and I do crunch the numbers on this stuff. I have an app that helps me do that. I compared our recent Norwalk trip to our trip to Eastern Montana. It turned out we didn't do the whole trip for reasons of contagion, but it's interesting how close they were. So the Montana trip was higher speed, so lower efficiency for that reason. The Connecticut trip was lower temperatures, so slightly lower efficiency for that reason. It washed out. And as Phil knows too, once you get in a, I'm sure other cars are like this as well. I've only road trip Teslas, but it's only the first leg of the day where your battery is cold. After that, your battery is warm. You're stopping. When you charge, it heats up even more. And you are basically driving at summertime battery temperatures for the rest of the day. So here's the number, the single number. Spent about 17% of the total trip time charging, stopping to charge. So that means like on a 600 odd mile day, it took us, you know, 11 and a half hours, of which 9.5, 10 hours was spent driving and 1.5 hours was spent charging, just as an example. So 6 divided by 1.5 hours, yeah, about 15 minutes per stop, something like that.
And you integrate those stops with a meal or something.
I need them. I mean, my biology is such that I need a stop every 100 miles for 10 or 15 minutes. It turns out perfect.
So the way I calculate it, so when we went to Boston, we did it over 4 days. When we came back, we did it over 4 days. And the way I did it was I said, okay, every time I stop, I'm going to subtract 10 minutes off that time because I had to go to the bathroom anyway, or my wife had to go to the bathroom. If we ate for lunch, that was 0 minutes because we were going to 0 minutes charging because we were eating lunch anyway.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And if we were at a hotel, that was 0 minutes. So to Boston, it took an extra 100 minutes over 14 charging stops, which would have been 7 minutes a charge stop. On the way back from Boston to Minnesota, we went via Sault Ste. Marie, Ottawa, Sault Ste. Marie, and that was 154 minutes. That was an extra 10 minutes per stop.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was trivial.
Okay, so for 52 weeks in a year, you travel for 4 weeks, like you guys just said, maybe. And for 48 weeks, if you're a typical commuter, you're stopping at the gas station once a week.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't matter if it's 20 below zero. Doesn't matter if it's slushy. Doesn't matter if it's 100 degrees outside. You're standing outside with your pump, you know, attached to your car. You had to drive to the gas station. Maybe you had to wait for a second to get into the thing. It's smelly. You got to plug this thing into your car and drive home. Or maybe you go out of your way to work or something. But the point is, 48 weeks of the year, you're going to a gas station if you have an ICE car. But if you don't, you're just putting your car in your garage.
Yeah, so it took you an extra 12 hours to do all that gas pumping.
I threw a real quick spreadsheet together on that. And, you know, you can... I would make it available to people so you can plug in your own numbers. But yeah, basically the time you save charging at home, which is 90%+ of the time, against the time, extra time that you spend on road trips, depending on the ratio of those miles, you know, you're break even, you're better with an EV, or if you do a whole lot of road tripping, maybe you're spending a few extra minutes a year driving the EV, but it's pretty much a wash.
Yeah.
People, so my, yeah, this is a classic question at a car event. How long does it take to charge? And if I size up the person and I sense they're probably up for a little dry humor, I say, about 10 seconds.
Yeah. Yeah. That's all it takes you to plug it in when you go back, go into your home.
Exactly.
Day, right.
Yep.
Right. Yeah.
So that's a good answer.
It's almost like electric cars are a good thing.
Almost.
Yeah. I think Alan Wernke has a great line for long distance travel. Cars charged before, car is done before I'm done.
Yep. Yeah, a good share of the time. If I had done that extra math that you did, Phil, you're always doing more math than I am. I'm not going to try to compete there, but yeah, if you really subtract off the non-wasted time, it gets to be very small indeed.
Yeah. So Greg, I have to tell you how I got introduced to Brian Anderson. I was at the Blues Brews and Barbecue at Mount Olivet. Mm-hmm. And Wayne Wilson just says, yeah, that Brian Anderson over there, he's interested in electric cars. Oh, okay. This is what, 2015 about? Yeah. And then so I walked to my car, got my laminated spreadsheet and handed it to Brian.
The first time I saw Phil, he had his laminates in his hand.
Right.
He was ready to give me the numbers.
Yeah, for those who don't already know Phil has laminated sheets for everything having to do with electrical generation. Yep. and cars and...
Yeah. I don't even try to compete. I don't actually candle to candle to Phil.
But just so people understand, Phil is not just some weird guy who likes to laminate things, but he's involved in messaging and communication.
Yeah.
And this is part of one of his tools.
Yeah.
Well, we both
you know, Brian, think, Brian, yeah. Do you know that Phil has now shifted out of laminates and into Legos?
Into what? Legos?
Yeah.
Legos.
Wow. You can send the same messages with Legos.
I suppose.
Yeah. I don't know if I put it on Facebook, but I don't know that anybody I didn't get any likes on it, so I don't think it got them. I don't even think it got seen, which is fine, but it was in response to a someone telling me not to shove electric cars down their throat, and I thought that was the strangest response I'd ever heard.
We have this problem, like in the last few years here in Minnesota, we've been trying to get electric car standard, which we got an electric car standard. What happened? Well, the head of the department that handles that stuff got fired by the Republican Party in our legislature, because they can do that. We tried to get an electric truck memorandum of agreement signed by our governor last year, which is something a lot of governors have signed around the country saying we're going to do this and that to improve the chances of electric trucks being adopted by various state agencies and city agencies, et cetera. And he said, I'll do it maybe later. I can't do it now because it's a politically hot issue. Why would it be a hot issue? It's politically difficult. It shouldn't be one. And part of this is because we had when the electric car standard hearings were happening, people were testifying. We had people from outstate Minnesota saying, from farmland saying, if you force a standard on us, my children will die. And they had an argument that ran from being forced to use an electric car in their farm, electric tractors in their farm, to not being able to produce the food and going out of business and becoming homeless. Now, that was ridiculous because no one was forcing anyone to use electric tractors. Tractors are the edge case. We don't have that solved yet. But part of the argument behind this was being footed by the car dealers. And we came to understand that car dealers in Minnesota were against electric vehicles, not because they wouldn't be able to sell them, because like you said, Brian, earlier, they'd be able to sell a lot more cars if they had a range of electric cars on their lots, but because they can't fix them. Most car dealers have a significant part of their business is based upon fixing cars. They have, have shops, and they have a warranty system. And a good part of their income is keeping those cars up, maintained and up and upgraded. And when you replace all the ICE cars, which always break all the time and get old and wear out because they're basically little bombs that are constantly going off thousands of times a minute, and replace them with electric cars that don't require that kind of maintenance, they will lose. They'll be taking a hit, and I feel bad for them. And I think we should help them, as long as they stop trying to stop electric cars from being sold in the state. Do you have any last minute thoughts about what you want people to hear about electrification of our transport system, especially focused on electric cars?
I'm really excited about the heavy duty side. I think that is going to surprise people how quickly we can electrify probably first local deliveries from the big guys, Amazon, UPS, FedEx, to the mom and pops. I mean, as soon as I'm trying to think of, there's a local delivery company called Speedy. Mm-hmm. I don't know how.
St. Cloud.
I don't know how big an organization they are, but, the economics are compelling. And that is the most exciting thing to me, is that once you just, it's just purely a matter of education, I think. And especially on the commercial side, cities, municipalities are another example where, they're just trying to save taxpayers money. And as soon as they get it, that they run the numbers, crunch the numbers, and realize that this saves money. Oh, and by the way, reduces emissions. We're going to be supply constrained, I think, for quite a while. Mm-hmm.
Based on the gas tax, the state of Minnesota burns about $13 to $15 billion a year on gasoline, and it would be 1.5 to 2 if it was electric. Rural communities, they would be buying electricity from their local utility, and not from the refinery.
That's another one of your great laminates, Phil. No, it stays local.
It is.
Yeah. Buying local.
Hi, this is Mike joining in late. I wasn't able to make this particular recording, but I was glad that Brian and Phil did provide their expertise on electrical vehicles. I hope that this answered a lot of the questions that our listening audience may have on the advantages and address the questions that what most people see as disadvantages of electric vehicles are. And there is one other type of vehicle, a new car manufacturer that is in process of expanding beyond China and Northern Europe and is even in parts of California. It's NIO, and it's an electric car manufacturer that one of the things that they're changing is a model for how they provide the batteries. Rather than actually buying a car with a battery, which can save you up to $10,000 on the list price, you buy a subscription to battery power. And then rather than charging the car, then you go to a service station, and at no charge at the time of service, then robotically the battery is taken out and a new charged battery is installed, and the inventory of the batteries cycles so that it continually refreshes, and then as batteries get older and less effective at storing power, then they are taken out of service and put into a recycling program where they're used for other purposes. So that's definitely something that gives an example of how engineers are trying to solve some of the problems that we still see that cause hesitation in switching over to an electrical vehicle fleet. So if you want to take a look at that, I'm actually adding a link to the NIO car company, and hopefully some other manufacturers will take up this model and allow it to become more popular. This was a great episode. Again, I want to thank Brian, Phil, and Greg for a great conversation. We'll be talking again to Laurent Panet fairly soon, and that'll be the next episode, and we'll continue with that conversation on agriculture and some of the changes that can and need to be made in order to help feed a growing world while reducing environmental load. Thanks again for joining the Econocast. It was my pleasure recording this episode for you.